come up on Taiwan.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, when our guest is going to be...
Brian Turner, poet and memoirist.
And he is most known for his books of poems, Hear Bullet and Phantom Noise.
And now
but
his
he
new
just
memoir.
Came out with a memoir. And
My
it's
Life
called,
as a Foreign
My Life
Country.
As a Foreign Country. And we're going to talk about that. Yeah. It's going to be an exciting show. And also... We both know him personally.
We've had the privilege.
We're going to talk about it. You know, one of the things that strikes, I think, both of us, because Tim and I have had this conversation about this book, is how much Brian Turner has traveled, not just, you know, to go to war, which is really, what a lot of this book is about, but he's traveled into so many different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what effect traveling so much has on the way we write. I know you just got back from Mexico.
I did.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it might have affected your writing?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I had just gotten back doing this research trip, in January, as you know. And when I got back, there on my desk was a copy of Brian Turner's book, My Life as a Foreign Country.
Nice.
And it immediately resonated with me. And, one would think, because my surname is Hernandez, even though I'm a third generation Chicano born in California.
And you look, 100% Mexican.
That's right.
I wouldn't see you walking down the street and say, oh, there's an Irish guy.
There's an Irish guy, yeah. You would think then, like, how foreign can he be, being in Mexico? But I understood that sort of sense of foreignness being in Mexico and not having a mastery of the language. And one of the things that came to me, I traveled quite a bit actually when I was 18, 19. But when you're 18 or 19, it's kind of, you're doing,
it's a blur.
It's a blur, man. You're not really, you're not present, you're looking for booze, man,
Right.
And, but for this time anyway, just that sense of – that heightened sense of awareness, you suddenly find yourself using communication muscles and skills that you normally don't use here because you're so comfortable in that. And of course, you know better than I do because you've much more traveled. But you get that sense also even in – as I read Brian's book, and we'll talk more about it, you get that sense throughout his book, too. There's a heightened sense of awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. I think entering into a new city in general, especially when it's a city where they don't speak the language that you're used to speaking, your senses are so heightened. But you mentioned going to Mexico as a Chicano, and as a Chicano who really hasn't mastered the language.
Right.
I remember the first time I went to Mexico, it was right out of grad school. I got my first job at a community college, and it paid me wages. I mean, wages. Suddenly I'm getting a paycheck. So I go to Mexico City for, I think it was 3 weeks. In California, I am a Chicano, man.
Of course.
I am bien Chicano.
I am puro Chicano. Muy Chicano.
I fly into El DF, and even though I have a nopal on my frente, man, I am 100% gringo.
Yeah.
And I remember I was at Chapultepec Park, which is a really beautiful park in Mexico City.
Right.
And they had a clown, and there was hundreds of people laughing at the clown's words, which I didn't understand. My Spanish back then wasn't very good. And I make my way into the crowd, and the clown just suddenly looks at me and says, "Ah, un gringo."
Wow.
And I'm thinking, how the hell does he know?
What were you wearing that day?
I know. It's amazing. But we are definitely other in Mexico. And so, that experience, I think, heightens our awareness even more.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, in what you've traveled to Mexico, and then I'm trying to talk you into going to Paris this summer because I'm going to be in Paris with some students. And I want to get
twisting
a
my arm,
there. So I tried to talk you to go to Paris this summer. But how do you think the travel, the being othered, the being separated, the being hyper aware, how that has an effect on our writing itself?
For sure. And, that was one of the things I wrote quite a bit in my journal about during the time there was, not having a sort of mastery of the language. Say I was, completely fluent in Spanish and I'm in Mexico, well, I would be engaged more rather than sort of resigned to this place of listening more.
Mm-hmm.
And, I do understand like 99% of what I hear. So I was really kind of in this position to just witness. There were times when I wanted to contribute and even times when I did. For the most part, I sat back and listened and observed. And for a writer, that's like to absorb all that is really what I think we need, at least because the subject of my next book is based on Mexico and all that. It was really something that, I just was able to be present and hopefully will come through in the writing.
Right.
Yeah,
recently went to China and that was a very unique experience for me because it was the one place that I've ever been to in the world where I can't walk in and assume that they're going to understand my English and that when I get, like, for example, a menu with no pictures, I can't figure out the words like in any other country that I've been to. Usually I'm able to figure out because they have Western so-called
not even pictures,
characters
though.
but here it was the most amazing experience and
So what muscles did you end up using to communicate what you wanted? How did that happen? Like,
well, I don't want to talk about the muscles I used because that's kind of personal. But it really, but really sort of, was a great experience. Right. It really heightened my awareness. And I remember one time I was in riding the subway, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people on the subway. Millions of people ride the subway there every day.
Right.
And it was just so packed. And I'm trying to break my way through.
Right.
And suddenly this young man taps me on the shoulder. And, you know, my instinct, you know, right away is, what does he want? I turn around. He's this nice-looking young man.
Right.
And he doesn't speak any English. And he hands me my ATM card. And apparently I dropped it, on, you know, getting into the into the stall, like, you know, way back. And he was running after me through the crowd, following me, just so he can give it back to me.
Right.
And I don't know. That was really, really a beautiful experience.
Nice.
Anyway, let's talk to Brian.
Yeah, let's talk to Brian. Brian Turner is an American poet, essayist, and director of Sierra Nevada College's Low Residency MFA program. His numerous awards include the Beatrice Howley Award, Lannan Literary Fellowship, NEA, Amy Lowell Traveling Scholarship, and too many to mention. His debut collection of poems, Here Bullet, received rave reviews and was translated into numerous languages. Of the book, the New York Times Book Review said Turner has sent back a dispatch from a place more arguably incomprehensible than the moon. Turner's second collection, Phantom Noise, continued to build momentum for his writing and career, leading to his most recent publication, a memoir titled My Life as a Foreign Country. It's a book that has been called achingly, disturbingly, shockingly beautiful, a poetic and mesmerizing account of Turner's experience as a soldier in Iraq, but mostly as a human being in the midst of war. Brian Turner, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, thanks for having me back. Great.
And congratulations on this new book, My Life as a Foreign Country, a Memoir. This is your first book of prose, isn't it?
It is. It, you know, it has my name on the cover, but so many hands, as you know, so many hands are involved in the making. So I'll take the thank you with and share it with all that were involved, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And what a compelling title. I really dug the title as soon as I saw it there on my desk, My Life as a Foreign Country. Fantastic. So looking forward to getting into this with you. One of the first things that struck me, Brian, was, are you familiar with the term one aeronautics?
No, not actually.
The idea of lucid dreaming, right? Lucid dreaming.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Being able to wake up in your own dream and sort of navigate, you know, what takes place in your dream. Well, anyway, the reason why I'm onto this right now is because my wife had recently picked up this book about it, and I was reading it. And then at the same time, I opened up your book, and the first thing that struck me is this sort of dream sequence that takes us across, you know, over everything. And so I wondered then, you know, if you had experienced any kind of lucid dreaming as a way, because dreams take place throughout the book.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like that, but I don't usually feel like I'm in control of the dream. Although, you know, I do worry about the conceit of the book starting out with a dream at the beginning, because then it can maybe undermine something that I believe very much in, which is the real nature of the imagination. So, like, the what we dream or what we imagine, what we think about, that those are, for me, I believe those are real spaces as much as this one is, where I'm sitting in Orlando, Florida, and we're talking to each other from different parts of the world.
You know? Well, I totally agree with you. I think that what we imagine, just, you know, based on the infinity of the universe or the multiverse, has to exist, just on that level alone. But absolutely, what is real is not necessarily matter. In fact, we know matter isn't even that real. But the dream that Tim is referring to is imagining yourself as a drone flying over you and your sleeping wife and observing yourself. And the book begins and it ends that way, and which is really kind of I won't call it a frame, because frame just seems like some sort of, you know, cheap technique of a writer. But I like how everything is couched between these two.
Yeah.
These
it's appropriate.
Two dreams.
It's totally appropriate, because the book itself, all of it, sort of is really a space. You know, that's what I get. It's very, so obviously it's poetic and lyrical, but there's a space that's created, and you feel like more than a linear sort of story that's being told. I feel like I'm constantly put into a space.
I like that. One of the things that I was intrigued by, and the drone initially was there, but I didn't realize that, I didn't know where, if it might return or that kind of thing as I was writing the book, but the idea of the drone there, and there's something about drones in general, but putting a version of myself in the drone created this sort of, I guess, this semi-objective kind of distancing or perspective. And I don't mean in a way where it's where it doesn't also have its own calculation and its own there's questions around that kind of objectivity. Because in this case, it's a very dangerous one, you know, because drones are usually loaded with weapons and that kind of thing. And so, but that separation of self is what I was really intrigued by. And I'm glad that it came back up in the book later and then fully appeared at the very end, because it seemed to make a lot of sense to me, because it ties back into the title, as you both mentioned. And the title, this idea of being... having different countries within oneself different time periods that still coexist within a person. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Right. You know, in fact, this book is not necessarily a linear narrative. It has 136 sections, I believe, some of them very short and some of them a little bit longer. But the imagination that you are allowing to guide the structure and the scenes of this book, because it starts off with that drone and we're kind of seeing your outside of body, this out of body experience, you have these sections where you go into the minds of soldiers, you go into the minds of a kamikaze, you go in the minds of a suicide bomber, a younger Iraqi woman. Your imagination just allows you to completely enter into their consciousness. How did that come about? Was that just you follow language and it happened, or...
I think in different instances, you know, sometimes that, because that's my usual approach with poetry.
Right.
And so I think when I leaned towards the larger, you know, sort of canvas, the prose page, you know, it's, I think part of sound and image and rhythm drew me to some of those things. But some of it's also, I think just part of, I wouldn't want to say that it's just me, because I think a lot of people have this curiosity and this empathetic move to wonder what is it like outside of my own experience, you know, and to try to, as a writer, explore that and then to see how does it fit into this larger space.
Right. And the imagination, I think, is a legitimate way to capture what others are feeling, even if they wouldn't use the exact same language to describe it, it does allow us to have empathy, I guess you can say.
Yeah, you know, I used to think about the soldiers to my left and right, for example, in Iraq, and actually, no, I shouldn't say that. I'm not sure if I thought about this while I was there, but to see, I've been asked before questions that lead to this idea, which is, I would be surprised if soldiers to my left and right didn't, at some point during their time, say in Iraq, for example, or if they were in Afghanistan, to not only think about their own lives, but to look at the person in the market who's purchasing vegetables and just wonder about their lives, you know,
right.
Like, how do they make it through the day and what are their concerns and all those things.
Right.
For me, it seemed impossible not to think like that. That just seems like a natural part of our lives.
Yeah, and it felt really sort of, it felt like a natural, you know, movement in the book when you were doing that. You know, there were times when I know you would sort of jump into the children that were witnessing some of this and how they would have to go about their day after you guys left. And, you know, there were things like that really sort of resonated with me. You mentioned, you know, your experience in poetry really sort of feeding into or informing at least the way that you approached this memoir. And I'm wondering then, you know, yourself having written two prior wonderful and successful books of poetry, collections of poetry, now moving into this memoir, were there times where you felt you had to sort of pull the I guess you call them the poetry reins back a little bit as you were writing this?
I'm not sure if I'd phrase it that way, but I'm with you. You know what I mean? I think what I ended up doing was hiding a couple more poems. So I guess, yeah. There are pieces in there that I think are pretty much poems, and one that was a poem on the page when it originally appeared, but then I sort of smashed it down into a prose-looking paragraph. And
I like that. Smashed it down into prose.
right. Yeah. Yeah. For one example is on 49. I think it's the section 49 where you use the soldiers, the repetition of the soldiers enter the house, the soldiers enter the house.
Right.
That happens throughout. And every time I get to these little sort of morsels of poetry, I get excited personally because, you know, it's like, yes, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I appreciated that.
One, interestingly, I'm totally with you on that, because that's exactly how I feel about it, too, especially that piece. Because that repetition is right in the poet's toolkit, you know, it's part of what drives much of my poetry. But that comes from Rick Moody. I'd seen him read a piece called The Boys from Demonology.
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah, right. And so this one's really in conversation with that piece. In fact, I ended up you know, emailing him a letter and saying, hey, are you okay with this? Because like, I want to make sure you're okay. I don't want to just have him, you know, be mad at me or think I feel like he was, I was ripping him off or something. But he created that story, The Boys. Boys is, it's just this perfect vehicle. It has great velocity in it. And I just remember being fascinated by it. And I wanted to, it felt right for what I was trying to do with this other piece.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yours progresses in that same way that Rick Moody's does. I know the sort of the storyline or the narrative that happens every time you repeat it. There's a sort of progression that, that occurs, you know, a tension that rises and all that. And that's what happens in yours as well. I mean, it's, I think it was successful. And,
thank you.
We're talking to Brian Turner, whose new memoir, My Life as a Foreign Country, just came out with W.W. Norton. It's also apparently came out at the same time in the UK. That's pretty exciting. Are you, do you have any plans on going there and doing some readings and interviews?
Well, it's been an odd sort of, I guess the progression of the book has been unusual because normally, you know, you would think I would say if I got a contract here, then maybe there would be a contract rights person that would work, say, with the UK. Mm-hmm. But this way it worked in a different route. And that's because if you sort of took me back to about 2006 and I've just come back from the war and my first book of poetry has come out, Here, Bullet, and it was picked up in by Blood X Books, and I did a book tour over in England with those poems, and I met, there was an agent that sought me out, and she was certain that I was going to write a novel, you know, and I thought, maybe, you know, I don't know, you know, and I have yet to write that novel, but I started writing, I wrote this essay for Ted Genoways was with VQR, and at that point he asked me to sort of challenged me to write a series of haibun, and I'd never written those before, but and it was an interesting challenge. I ended up writing a chapter that I thought would be in an early version of this book, but that was scrapped, and it just didn't work, but it did teach me a lot about what I could do with the form, getting back to poetry on the page within prose, you know.
Right.
It was published in VQR as My Life as a Foreign Country, this essay, and that sort of fragmented, very short essay became the book proposal, in effect, and also the genesis of this book.
And this book is doing really well. Right. It's got reviewed by the New York Times. The New York Times says, and I quote, Brian Turner's stunning war memoir is a triumph of form and content and a praiseworthy example of how the empathetic imagination can function beautifully in nonfiction writing.
Right.
Reviewed by the Washington Post, reviewed by all these major news, and it's doing very well, and certainly deserves it. Are you doing a book tour?
Well, it's sort of slowed down a little bit now for the spring, but it's sort of ongoing throughout the spring, but it's not at the kind of pace it was in the fall. It was just a pretty frenetic pace in the fall. And March 11th is when the large print version comes out, and then Audible will have an audio version of the book that comes out.
Who's going to read it? Who's going to read it?
Oh, if I can remember, it's Kevin King, I believe. Kevin Collins, I believe his name is. Really nice guy. I'm bad with names, but he's, I did some stalking of his work. And
You got to do it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, one of the things about the book that really struck me as well is as you're telling us this story, as the narrative is unfolding, you're also teaching us the language and concepts of war. You're teaching the reader that as they're going along. And obviously, it's a great sort of technique or approach to making it accessible, right, to all readers and not simply those who've been through that experience. And I'm curious to know, sort of by extension of that, you know, how has the reception for the book as you're going around reading and doing that kind of thing and speaking in public, you know, how's the sort of general reception been?
It's been pretty good. I think sometimes it's interesting, similar with poetry books, you know, the material itself seems to draw certain people there. I guess what I mean, there's sometimes there'll be folks that show up, I think, because they know, they hear there's a veteran writer guy coming to town. Mm-hmm. So they come to the reading, and then I think it's not what they maybe thought it was going to be,
right.
Which is exactly the conversation that I'm really, right. You know, it's awkward, but it's a necessary one. Right. So that's it's a good thing when it happens, but sometimes it can be a bit nerve wracking, you know, sometimes because you don't know if the person's fully stable. You know, I don't know if they're stable sometimes. Right. You know, I've been yelled at a couple times here and there. Or at least once I was yelled at. I was
really?
Yelled at with a weird phrase, which was God bless America. But the guy yelled it at me like, God bless America, you know. To be fair, he had just thanked me for, he said, thank you for your service and God bless America, and yelled it at me. Who knows? Long ago, one of my great teachers, T.R. Hummer,
I know him.
Right? Yeah. He told me, he said, you know, once your work is out there, it's, you know, he didn't advise responding to critics because once your work's out there, it has to survive on its own, you know. So,
right.
But a reading, it's hard because your critic can be right there in your face, sort of like at a. I was listening to a comedy show last night. Larry Willis, I forget his name. It's a new comedy show after Jon Stewart, and they were joking about how do you respond to hecklers when you're doing comedy stand-up routines and stuff. And I don't think the way some comics have to deal with them, it doesn't seem to work that well in a poetry area. So, and you know, I guess one thing that I would share is that, and I think is maybe useful, is that it's intriguing to me that, you know, that a lot of people from Vietnam, the Vietnam era, will come up in a lot of different walks of life. People that maybe didn't get drafted, but have some guilt about it and not going. Yeah. Wow. Even if they really didn't believe in the war or thought it was wrong, or you know, they still have this kind of very difficult relationship with that experience. And and then those who served and were there, whether they were drafted or they signed up to go, a lot of them have come out and been very supportive, or at least have been in dialogue with the book. So that's been a wonderful thing. Yeah.
But you know, one of the things I admire about this book, the imaginative power of the narrative, is that it could not only bring us, you know, and watch you sleeping with your wife and go over Bosnia and go over Iraq, but could also go into the past and in solidarity with soldiers who really don't have much of a connection other than an emotional or, I don't know, maybe even fraternal connection with you as a soldier. Right. It goes into your World War II. It goes into the Civil War, and I love that it could do that, and it can go into the imaginations and the thoughts of the soldiers. But in the part about the Civil War, there's this wonderful detail where it says barrels of those teeth, because there's a whole bunch of teeth, you know, that have been collected in the battlefields, which is really a horrible, horrible image. But you say barrels of those teeth had been sent to American dentists for dentures they made. Is that true? Where did you get that?
Yeah, actually, that's from my wonderful wife, Elise Kuznets. She had come across the story and sent it to me, and then I, you know, followed up on it. But yeah, apparently, you can even look at, you know, they used to call them Waterloo teeth, because what had happened was during the battle, you know, in Waterloo, there were so many dead young men with healthy teeth, because at the time, dentistry wasn't, you know, all that advanced. And so wealthy folks wanted those teeth because their dentures had been – dentures with human teeth were, I guess, a newer thing at the time. I could be wrong about that, but I do know that they used the teeth from Waterloo as sort of a boon to the dentist industry. It was even in dentist catalogs, you know, dentistry catalogs of the day.
Wow.
And they would sell them there. So then those were – barrels of those were shipped to America at the time. And then, you know, as that supply ran out, they still called them Waterloo teeth because people knew – it was like Nike. It was a brand kind of name. It, you know, it had that kind of attachment to the idea of what it meant by in terms of quality.
Jeez.
And but they ran out of those teeth. But by the time of the 1860s and the American Civil War, then those barrels started shipping the other direction. And so French and British folks who could afford them had, you know, they would smile and look at each other and eat their meals with the teeth of the dead American soldiers in their mouths.
It's incredible.
So as you allow your imagination to enter into the consciousness of soldiers who just have been dead for a long time or on other battlefields, did you ever find that you really felt you were occupying their space, that you were really occupying their bodies?
I think the most I felt like that was during that scene that you just mentioned. And also a scene with my grandfather. There's a scene with my grandfather in the Solomon Islands fighting against the Japanese as a Marine in the Pacific during World War II. And it's something I've been fascinated with my whole life because it's a very silent part of him for me, with limited access for me to learn from, you know, so because he didn't talk to me about it very much. And it did come up some, but he didn't talk a lot about it. He talked about it with my dad and with other veterans in the family, I believe, sometimes. But for the most part, I had limited access. So there was a book here called The Third Marine Division. That was written in 1949, and it's a unit history done by guys who were in the unit while they were still serving. So there were a couple officers that had been there through that fighting. with a very short time frame, you know, 4 years later, which is still enough time for the memory, you know, of course, to really get washed out and rearranged and all. But I think they did it seems like they did a pretty good job of outlining the events, and they're very methodical, very logistical in their writing. Like, this happened, here's the material, these people went this way, the fighting was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very cut and dried, very like a recipe kind of narrative. So that was useful for me factually, but it didn't really get me into the space. And so I was really, you know, fascinated by the Solomons themselves. So I, you know, I'd find myself at 3-4 in the morning on my third different essay or like scientific paper talking about a certain type of butterfly, you know. So I was going to try to get like soil composition and rain patterns and the wind patterns and, you know, soil erosion on the beaches.
Oh, and you even used like, the term sandy loam, which
yeah. That's right.
Yeah, you got me with that one. Well, you are an amazing poet and everybody knows it. And we have this feature on our show called Poem of the Week, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to pull one of your poetry books off the shelf and read something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nice. Let's see here. Okay, well, here's a difficult one, so maybe that'll be unexpected. And yeah, it starts with a quote from a news reporter, which I heard, which says that 1 in 3 female soldiers will experience sexual assault while serving in the military. And the poem is called Insignia. She hides under a deucenhalf this time, sleeping on a roll of foam draped in mosquito netting. Sandflies hover throughout the night. She sleeps under vehicle exhaust and heat, dreaming of mortars buried beside her, 3 stripes painted on each cold tube, a rocker of yellow hung below. It's you she's dreaming of, Sergeant. She'll dream of you for years to come. If she makes it out of this country alive, which she probably will, you will be the fire and the hovering breath, not the sniper, not the bomber in the streets, you. So I'm here to ask for this one night's reprieve. Let her sleep tonight. Let her sleep. Pause a moment under the gibbous moon. Smoke. The gin your wife sent from New Jersey, colored mint green with food dye disguised in a bottle of mouthwash. Take a long swig of it. Take the edge out of your knuckles. Let it blur your vision into a tremor of lights. The explosions in the distance are not your own. In these long hours before dawn, on the banks of the Tigris River, they're asleep. In her dream, her eyes are pools of rifle oil. You unsheathe the bayonet from its scabbard while she waits. On a mattress of sand and foam, there in the motor pool, she waits to kiss bullets into your mouth.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Wow. That was Brian Turner. What was the name of that poem, Brian?
It's called Insignia. And Insignia, for those who don't know, for the poem, Some uniforms have, dress uniforms have 3 stripes for a sergeant and a rocker of yellow hung below for a signifying a staff sergeant. So,
Well, that was fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. We wish you the best of
thank
luck
so
on
much,
my
Brent
life
Turner.
As a foreign
guys,
country.
Yeah. Thanks for doing what you guys do, man. Keeping words alive and the imagination a real thing.
We'd like to thank our guest, Brian Turner, for joining us on this edition of Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
And don't forget, the next book you read
could save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.